back. Put your feet up. Have one of your favorite beverages. And enjoy this radio show. This is the Mix Files. We appreciate you listening again. If you've listened before, if it's your first time, we appreciate you too. Hope you enjoy. We're listening to the music of Mac Sanders. Mac is one of the fine musicians on Mixposure.com. Mac and I will be talking about Fibonacci waves in music. We will be talking about how Mac looks at music, his approach to music. You are listening to The Mix Files, a weekly radio show which airs on Mixstream Radio from Mixposure.com. And it premieres once a week on Saturday Night Rocks with EBS and Friends. So here you go. Here's some Mac Sanders music at the end of this show. I will include the names of all of the tunes. Fail to mention them. At the end, have your pens and paper ready. And I'm Cooter. Just start with how you got into music.
Yeah. Music for me started January 6, 1952. I don't know what day it was, but I do remember when noontime came around because I had just been born. And my grandmother, who was a midwife, wrapped me up and laid me on the couch in a blanket. Dad came home for lunch, bell telephone. Uh-huh. the family has, now his older brother had owned for some time, I think he brought it back from one of the WPA programs, a D18 Martin.
Oh, boy.
That he had walked from Greenville, South Carolina, up into the foothills, Walhalla, I think, somewhere around there, with it down the railroad track. Anyway, Dad sat down and stuffed that guitar into those blankets, not realizing that I was born. And he played for me, and it woke me up, but I didn't cry. I saw light, and I felt the sound.
And you remember that?
I feel it now.
That's amazing.
I don't know. We were talking about the various folks in the family, how they were, born and the circumstances that followed. My nephew, spent some time in ICU at that time, which, was probably about as far drastically removed of a contrast as you can have from where I think I have the best situation that has ever been. Mm-hmm. And in that, I feel that sound. When I get around Martins, I work on Martins. A friend handed me one that needs some refretting work last week. And I get darn well protective of those guitars because of that sound, I think. There's something that I'm just really, really attached to.
Mm-hmm.
And from that time on, I was listening to Dad play Chet Atkins style. I was very, very good at it.
Cool.
Merle Travis. Chet, at that time, a lot of the recordings we were hearing from were from the late 40s, and he had a lot of flamenco stuff. He was playing on electric guitar and classical stuff. Dad had the Martin, and then he acquired a 1954 Stratocaster, which was the first electric guitar that I ever saw.
The 54s have... don't they have kind of an interesting neck on them? Don't they have a V-shaped neck?
They do.
54s?
Yeah, I had a 58 that I can tell you about. It was an interesting story that I just found out recently. But I had the 54, and I was able to stand up on, and hold onto his knee and play, with the strings. He had built his amplifier, the electronics and everything, studying for radio engineering.
Mm-hmm.
He had an ES-350T Gibson, which is a beautiful F-hole. It was a jazz guitar, Sunburst.
And for those, I'm sorry to interrupt you, for those who don't know, and the F-hole is the cutout on the body of the guitar where the sound goes in and resonates and back out, as opposed to an acoustic guitar having that round hole.
The sound hole,
The sound hole, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there, and then there was a 1956 Birdland guitar, Gibson Birdland, which was, I think we believe it is the second of 25 in a line of prototypes that were produced.
Wow.
By Gibson for Hank Garland and Billy Bird, 1956. And that was the guitar that I was raised on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Got lucky. That's a good one.
Yeah. A J200, custom J200 Gibson. Right. Mm-hmm. I had a 58 Stratocaster that was black with a V-neck many years later. I was around 20, 22.
Mm-hmm.
I traded for it, $150 basically in it or less. I kept it for probably until about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And sold it to a friend, took the pickups off of it and put it on the guitar that David and I were raised with,
mm-hmm.
62. And recently a friend of mine who had kept up with where the guitar went told me, and this is staggering to me, but this is what's been said to me. The guitar was taken to Eric Clapton by the person that I sold it to.
Wow.
Clapton recognized the guitar.
Recognized it?
He recognized it because it was one of his.
Oh.
And I took the pickups out of it and put it in 62. But there for a time, according to these folks, and according to what I heard them say, at one point on Blackie.
Wow.
I've got some I'm on some videos, television videos from WIS in Columbia, South Carolina, with a group called Anthem, as you can see on YouTube. And if you see a black Stratocaster, it's got a brass pick guard on it at that point. Mm-hmm. I did that in a search to try to keep noise from happening. Mm-hmm. But that is one of the original Blackies. I think there was a handful of them. And what he did was he just put parts together. Mm-hmm. But he recognized the serial numbers and so forth on the guitar. And actually still have part of that guitar.
Wow.
Here. We had...
And you still have the pickups.
I still have the pickups and a guitar and a 62 Stratocaster.
Wow.
My brother's. Mm-hmm. Which I recently did a refret on it, so back in service. I've been doing a lot of refretting on guitars here recently.
Cool.
For customers.
Before you were weaned, really?
Pretty much. I had a flat top guitar when I was 3 or 4 years old. Dad gave me a pocket knife, tuned the guitar to E major, and laid it in my lap and showed me how to play it with the bar, which we call the Sanders Traditional First Lesson, which I have given to my grandsons.
Cool.
2 out of 3 of my grandsons. And people come to me for lessons. That's the first thing that I teach them.
Cool.
And then I gradually put the pocket knife down and use my index finger stacked with all 4 fingers on it, fretting bar chord.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was gradually got to the place where I could use my index finger. And then the task was to tune from E major to E standard for my dad to play. Mm-hmm. And then he would hand it back to me and I would tune it into E major and play it, tune it back to E standard, give it back to him. Mm-hmm. And we did that on the 1956 Birdland.
Cool.
First time I actually stood in front of an audience and played was with that Birdland. The first song that I played and sang was Give My Love to Rose by Johnny Cash. I was first grade. Then Dad built me a bass out of a six string, and I played it right away. I joined the band as soon as we got to school, seventh grade. Wrote and sang, recorded my first record, which is still out there. Mm-hmm. It's called Go Ahead and Go, a band called the Bojacks. Mm-hmm. One of the original garage bands. Mm-hmm. And then it's been just been a steady diet of groups, you know, so many that it's kind of hard to count.
Yeah.
And some recordings. Played some openers with that Bojacks band. Played an opener for Herman's Hermits and the Hollies in 1968.
That's cool. That's cool.
At Charlotte Coliseum.
Uh-huh.
Then played in a band called Tomorrow, some of the same members. And I was playing lead guitar at that point, and we got a call to replace Blue Oyster Cult at Clemson Coliseum. Mm-hmm. And that was with Allman Brothers.
Cool.
Steely Dan. Canned Heat, if you remember Canned Heat.
Oh, yeah.
Who else? Some other guys there. But it was pretty interesting to sit around and listen to those guys talk. Because mm-hmm. a lot of things that I'm doing now are based on conversations I had then.
How so?
Well, the guy with Blue Oyster Cult, all the members didn't show up. But this guy, one guy was giving me... fairly much of a sermon on how it is that you choose necks for guitars. If you don't have a neck, then you don't have a guitar. And he talked about how much searching they did,
uh-huh.
how desperate the search was, you know, basically. They were on a quest. I saw the Allman Brothers drummers come in and lay down on the benches, the towels, and set up the metronomes and sleep listening to the time.
Jeez.
These people were severely dedicated to what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Severely dedicated. And, you know, I wanted some of that to rub off.
Yeah.
So just sitting there, just listening to things that they had to say,
mm-hmm.
I found out that sometimes speaking was not the right thing to do. As Roy Gallagher insulted me one time because I was saying something stupid, but listening was the thing that was important to do.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
about the price you paid. Oh, the anger when I cried out, when no one was around, when a bar falls in the jungle, guess he really doesn't make a sound.
See Deal last night when we were sitting in the chat room, comes on PM and starts telling me about a seminar that he had gone to at Sweetwater, where I don't know the guy's name, but the guy that produced Queen, some of those guys, was doing a seminar there. Mm-hmm. We get talking about compression and miking and stuff like that. You know, anything I can learn, you know, yeah, it's worth the effort. I mean, the whole thing that we do here in this apartment, the quest is to write and record songs. So far on the other end of the house is a drum room. Drums are set up in there live, microphones.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Cables are run to this end of the house. On the other side of the wall behind you is another recording facility. I got one on my side and one on his side. Record the drums from in there. I track the song. A lot of times I'll write a song, play bass, and play some guitars and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'll just ship it over to him on the other side. He'll put the drums on it.
Wow. That's convenient and cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, my whole life basically evolves around what it is that I'm going to make a guitar, how it is I'm going to make a guitar play in tune.
Mm-hmm.
It's all I do.
Yeah.
How I'm going to sing in tune, how I'm going to sing and play on time.
Mm-hmm.
And with what kind of phraseological strategy that I can devise
mm-hmm.
that will be acceptable.
Is that acceptable to you, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that something, well, I think you're telling me right now that it is, but let me ask you, is that something that you consciously think about before you even start singing the song, or do you just, does it develop kind of on its own until you just become happy with it?
Well, I'll tell you where the biggest lesson I think that came along with phrasing development,
mm-hmm.
came from singing White Shade of Pale. What I realized was, you know, and when I tried to imagine singing it before I actually started, I tried to develop the phrases farther than what Booker had done. And I realized that that was a song where the phrases were fully developed. And there was really nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that I could do is just pay respect to what it is that he'd already developed.
but I wander through my playing cards. And would not let her be one of 16 vessel virgins. We're leaving for the coast. And although my eyes were open, then I just as well been closed. And so as the meritorious tale, that her face that first just ghostly turned to whiter shade of
with guys on our level here is that the one thing that we miss most of all, and I see it, is going up. You know, I've got some friends and to get into higher places and so forth, and they'll have the knowledge of the harmony. They have the knowledge of how it is that you get things in tune and on time. Mm-hmm. They lack the knowledge sometimes of, or the willingness to fully develop the phrases.
Yes.
And that's my biggest thing. And as luck would have it, a major influence is my uncle, who is an architect, designer, engineer, several degrees. He says, whenever placement is an issue, find the golden mean in the situation and place accordingly. And so I delved in and sort of got the idea. I built some Fibonacci gauges just to see how it is that, you know, that they used them to build ancient Rome, you know, and started to try to understand what it is that the golden mean is and where you find it in nature. And I realize that just about anywhere you look, it is there.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Fibonacci was a gentleman who did a lot of work with mathematics, if I'm correct. Yeah. And the sequences that the Fibonacci numbers that you're talking about are found in seashells, conch shells, that curly wraparound thing. It's the proportions of starting small and at certain intervals it's proportionally larger than it was at the previous interval. And the same thing holds true for galaxies.
Exactly.
As a matter of fact.
From the ear to the galaxy.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Everything in between.
And somebody wanting more information on it than that can go Google it.
Yeah. You can find demonstrations of various things about it. What I've noticed is, and the reason why I come up with this, these three things, play in tune, play on time, and play with a phraseological strategy, a phraseological mean.
Mm-hmm.
A good example right now I'm looking at is a song we're going to do as a cover in the band, Sharp Dressed Man.
Mm-hmm.
ZZ Top. Now, there's a bunch of guys that are not in a hurry to do anything. But what they do is magical. And the reason why it's magical is because they understand this formula. Yeah, when they say, every girl's crazy about a sharp dressed man, you can dissect that phrase and you'll find golden mean in it. And that's, and you know, honestly, you know, when the drummer hits those four quarter notes at the end of that thing and then they come back in to the lead thing, mm-hmm. I can't wait to get on the stage and play those four quarter notes or to feel that, because they placed it so nicely. Anybody can play four quarter notes. But why are these so interesting?
Hey, hey, baby, do you want to go running down the street? Splash in the bottom with no shoes upon our feet. Girl, it's summer rain. Girl, that sure look good on you. Girl, the lightning is striking, and I know just what to do. So come on, baby, won't you keep on moving? Please don't stop. Sweet salvation, just a little bit further on down the block. Running one way and then the other. Never gonna stop. Don't pay no attention even to that traffic cop. So lose your umbrella, hold on to my hand. When the world comes crashing down, don't you need your loving man? One way, one way. Salvation, just a little.
leads me into a sort of a recent study, but I do realize that it goes back a good ways. And I realize how fortunate both me and my brother are to having traveled and worked with a musicologist, a professor. We had a private professor.
Wow.
Back during 75 till about 1980.
That must have been wonderful to be exposed to that.
It was. And one of the things that he had done some work along the Golden Mean lines when he would structure solos for us to take. Mm-hmm. Now, me being left-handed, playing right-handed guitar players, dyslexic, I can't read music very well. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it just sort of drives home the fact that I have to remember it and feel it.
Yeah.
So you get there however you can.
Yeah.
But one of his studies that we were involved in was on the subject of psychoacoustics. And we have, he's been long searching for an objective definition of what music is or what art is. And which leads me to modern day here, present day, and some of my research with having used Fibonacci fret profiles on guitars in order to get guitars to play in tune from one end to the other, which from what I understand from people even like Alan Parsons, that guitars are notorious for playing out of tune in certain areas and not in others. Mm-hmm. And so I stumbled into a development that makes me say, nope, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Not true. And along the way, what I've discovered is that when you exhaust your measuring capabilities with, say, a dial caliper, I got one laying right here, a dial caliper, mm-hmm. measures thousandths of an inch. You can get right there, just barely open it so that you can't even see through that. And you're looking at a thousandth of an inch.
Yeah.
If you relate that to length on from fret crown to bridge on a guitar, for purposes of intonation, mm-hmm. there's a point where the instruments that we use to measure it fail us. But then there is another instrument that comes to bear. It's much stronger and much more accurate than any of the electronic instruments or mechanical instrument. The human mental sense of order that everybody has. Mm-hmm. Everybody's born with it. When you get into the area where you start dicing a note, in other words, you take a half step, black key to white key. Mm-hmm. You divide that into 100 pieces. Right? Mm-hmm. And then you get to the place where your electronic instrument will allow you to divide that into one piece. What you will find is that the mental sense of order is able to perceive increments much smaller than that.
Okay, I was with you on the dividing it into 100 pieces, dividing a half step into 100 pieces. But then you said divide it into one piece, and I don't follow that.
Okay, you take one of those 100s, mm-hmm. and you divide that. We can divide it into we can divide one or two of those with our measuring instrument.
Even further.
What I'm saying is the mental faculty can divide one of those into 1,000 pieces. Mm-hmm. Incredible.
Yeah.
And every human being can do it. Mm-hmm. And what I've had to do in order to demonstrate my point is I would work on somebody's guitar with them watching me, and I would see that it would be a certain amount out of tune, and I would watch their body language, because music is the only art form that is perceived and evaluated with in an involuntary nature. So when you start to look at a human being to tell whether or not your guitar is in tune, what you're looking for is their sense of relaxation, a complete feeling of a sense of resolution is what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. Which means that you no longer need any kind of measuring instrument after you get that close. Mm-hmm. And most people live on the side of 1 2 3/100 of a semitone that are out of tune. And what we're attempting to do is step into the place where it's dead zero all the time. Mm-hmm. And then when we do step out, it's only by 1 or 2 cents. Mm-hmm. And when you get into that range, all of a sudden it becomes glaring obvious, you know, when you do it.
Yeah.
And then you go straight for it and get it back in tune real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Micro tuning.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're trying to get at. You know, just the fact that every human being has born within them the ability to perceive order of that magnitude, mm-hmm. regardless of whether they're educated on the subject or not.
Yeah. So
that floors me.
Yeah, it's incredible. I want to say imagination, but I saw a small piece on TV. I'm not sure if it was something I was flipping channels through this morning or yesterday afternoon. Somebody was saying it was a NASA guy, and he was showing, oh no, it was about the internet. It was a guy who had done something with the internet and created the first decoder for the internet. So the first signal that was sent over the internet was LO exclamation point, as in lo and behold. Mm-hmm. That was the first message that was sent on the internet. And it was sent through his router. He's the guy that came up with the idea of a common language so that one machine could communicate to another machine. He after he showed this router, which, you know, was, I suppose, maybe close to 6 feet tall, and this piece of equipment was a good foot taller than he was, and it had to be 4 feet wide and 2 or 3 feet deep, and he opened the big metal door on the front and showed all the stuff on the inside of it. And then he says, my wristwatch has more computing power than this did,
mm-hmm.
pointing to the big machine, talking about the differences. And who would have imagined at that time that you'd have a wristwatch that would have more power in it than this behemoth had, you know, mm-hmm. when they came out with that. But then you stack something like the wristwatch up to the human mind, and you got that big behemoth all over again.
She's pretty as you talk so sweet. Keep your step and walk. Think you're pulling the storm. Door is open, but you just might stay at home.
Exactly right. It does not matter whether a person is well versed on the subject or not. Anybody, regardless of who they are, can tell when things are right. They can tell when things are wrong. They may not be able to tell you in specific terms. Mm-hmm. And you know, basically, we're using this method to try to capture market share, marketplace here, and we're actually able to do it.
Cool.
Here. It's one of the things. Interesting. One of the things that happened back in 1978, we were friends with a guy named Nick Peck, who was president of NAMM, which is a music merchandisers organization.
Right.
He set us up to, he sold us a lot of gear, set us up to play at the World Trade Center, Atlanta, Georgia, 78.
Uh-huh.
And we played on a truck bed. At the entrance, and then the people would come in, Oriental mostly, on the planes. Mm-hmm. It was like several planes came in tandem and unloaded, and they all showed up in buses. And I had my fancy rig up there. It was a rack that was 4 feet tall. It had a speaker box on it that came from the Grateful Dead, and Macintosh amplifier that was in 1953, tube, Olympic preamp, LA-4 compressor limiter, universal audio, the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I had an Olympic guitar and a pedal out on the floor with a huge cable running into the... and I went through a few sound changes because the song called for it.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, there were several hundred... Asian people with cameras, and they were taking pictures of my gear. My gear was, stood 5 feet tall and weighed about 200 pounds.
Yeah.
But it was loaded with digital technology for that age.
Mm-hmm.
So, very advanced. And, they stayed there and took pictures for a long time while I was playing it, and none of them was from the waist, from higher than the guitar. They were not interested in me at all.
Uh-huh.
What happened was, the next year, what we saw was things like the Tom Scholz Rock Band come out wearing it on your belt. Had all that stuff in it.
Yeah. Yep.
The Ibanez, they built a guitar that looked like that. Back in that time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I had any direct influence, but maybe some. But
you never know.
Yeah.
It's
interesting to contemplate, but I no longer had to have that rolling rack that weighed 200 pounds. I could wear it on my belt.
Yeah.
And $200,
You are listening to The Mix Files on Mixstream Radio from Exposure.com. This has been part one of the Max Sanders interview. Parts one and two, after both have aired, will both be available for a download as a podcast. It's free. To get there, you go to MixPosure.com's homepage. You'll see a menu across the top, and Mix Radio will be one of your choices. And if you follow the drop-down menu from there to the podcast option and click on it, Bob's your uncle and you're there. I promised you the tunes that were included in this interview, part one. Home Fire's Burning, Three Piece Suit, Cry Wolf, Whiter Shade of Pale, Running for Cover, and Angels Are Looking the Other Way. Hope you join us for part two of this interview. I'm Cooter. This has been the Mix Files. Interview with Max Sanders, part one of two. Hope to see you again.